This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be looking back at the elections, Donald Rumsfeld's resignation, but also at the Iraq War and George Bush's foreign policy through a feminist lens. With me to talk about this is Cynthia Enloe, professor of international development, community, and social change, as well as women's studies at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. Cynthia Enloe is the author most recently of The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the New Age of Empire. Cynthia Enloe, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
It's nice to be here, Matt.
It's great to see you again. What was your reaction to the elections?
Well, I have to admit, I was quite buoyed by them. You know, I had the feeling that at least there was a crack in the monolith. And I think that's a good thing. I don't think I'm under any illusions that the Democrats are going to be a wildly progressive party as organized in Congress, and they're more diverse than ever. But, you know, it will make a difference. And if Nancy Pelosi really does follow through on one of her promises, which is that there'll be a lot of investigations, not only of the Iraq War, but of Katrina and of money spent on contractors, then in fact we may find out things that we otherwise hadn't, and perhaps the general public will learn some of the background that they have not been attentive to.
I sure hope she does issue those subpoenas, but I know she's under a lot of pressure from the pundits and from the so-called moderates and the people who are playing the angles already for 2008 that, you know, the Democrats should just sit on their hands and not issue subpoenas on the Iraq War or Halliburton, for instance, or impeachment, which is what I think John Conyers should be allowed to pursue.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things to watch is how much misogynist reporting there is, even by innuendo of Pelosi.
Did you think Bush's comment at his recent press conference the day after saying changing the drapery in the speaker's office was sexist?
Well, of course. I mean, it's just classic, you know. But I think there's going to be a lot worse than that.
What are you expecting?
I think there will be implicit remarks about whether – watch for the words shrill, watch for the words – they won't use hysterical with Pelosi. You can't. She's very, very controlled. But watch for all those kind of feminized, delegitimizing words. I think that she's going to be under a kind of pressure that Hastert never experienced.
Do you think she's up to it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think she's very smart. As I saw one commentator say that she's San Francisco on the inside, but Baltimore on the outside.
Have you ever met her?
No, I've never met her. No, I've never met her. No,
tell me
she's tough, I think.
She seems tough. Tell me what your reaction to Donald Rumsfeld's resignation was.
Well, you know, Matt, I think of at least all my pals that we immediately talked to each other when the news came out. I'm the only one, I think, that's disappointed. I actually didn't want Rumsfeld to be forced to resign.
Why?
I wanted him front and center. I wanted him to be right there so that you can't forget him. I think that, in fact, this is doing the Bush administration a favor to have him out of the picture. I think Gates, who they're bringing in now, will be much more palatable. He won't make any mistakes. He's not a bland person intellectually, but he'll come across as a good civil servant.
You know, bland, it's interesting. I think, you know, they've exchanged a brazen manipulator for a bland manipulator.
Yeah. Oh, Gates is very, very smart. I mean, he comes out of the CIA. You know, he's very, very good. And he won't ruffle the senior command as much. That's one of the reasons why they got rid of Rumsfeld, I think, is because it was not – us types who got him out. It was the senior military officers, both recently retired and active duty. No, I'm not happy necessarily about Rumsfeld's leaving.
Now, Rumsfeld typified, according to an article of yours that I saw, I think it was in an interview you did with Doug Henwood of Left Business Review or Left Business Observer, that Rumsfeld typified a kind of macho masculinity that was on display for the first 6 years of the Bush administration. Do you want to describe that?
Well, I think it's quite combative. I think it also plays the sort of I'm more masculine than you game with other men. I mean, from the books I've read describing Rumsfeld's behavior inside the Pentagon, he constantly is creating hierarchies of masculinity with the men around the table with him and really quite deliberately playing a game of humiliation.
You called it feminizing, that he tried to feminize Colin Powell.
Yes, right. And I think the State Department gets feminized. I think in our politics, the State Department is oftentimes feminized by the Defense Department. And that's not just this administration. It's looking down on people who don't wield weapons. So it's a real dynamic in American politics, I think.
It's also looking down on people who listen and people who negotiate. That those skills are somehow not worthy.
Yes, and then you paint that with not looking after American interests. You know, if you listen in Nigeria or you listen in South Korea, somehow you are less patriotic. So you combine that with the wielding of feminization, and you've got quite an effective way of dismissing the State Department, which, you know, the State Department is not always high on my list of admirable institutions, but I think that game is played.
What about Bush himself and his peculiar personality and the way he displays his own masculinity or the way he deals with all that?
Well, you know, I think it's – I mean, I do – I think it matters. I actually try really hard not to just keep track of the kind of masculinity that's, if you will, on display in public forums. I'm really quite interested in the kind of more structural – institutionalized masculinity. So there are people who are very good observers of kind of the parade of masculinity, and I think that matters. But I'm really interested in how it plays out behind the scenes or in policy debates, in actual policies. So I think, yes, I think there's no question but that George W. Has tried to wield masculinity. I think it's come around to this is a mixed metaphor, is to bite him, though, because when you parade masculinity and then it looks as though you're not effective, it looks like real sham.
And institutionally, then, at the focus that you like to stay at, how is masculinity so much a part and an influence in policy institutionally?
Well, I think in the recent years, it's really been this notion, it's been played out in this notion of a kind of militarized foreign policy is the only genuine expression of protection of American interests. And when you combine militarization, and this is being done by civilians primarily, and the wielding of masculinity, you really paint the American public into a box. But I mean, it's not just men. It's also women who oftentimes find this appealing. I mean, I'm very interested in this most recent election to see the exit polls. The recent ones I've heard of, but I haven't seen all the analysis yet, is that married women moved on this one. That was a very prominent demographic in 2004, and they moved away from this, if you will, the security mom tendency or appeal. But the other thing that one we should all watch for is that the exit polls show that married men moved even more than married women. Married men, according – now, this is the early exit polling analysis – split 50-50, Democrats and Republicans. That's news. That is, married men are usually who the Republicans can count on.
And how do you explain the move?
Well, I don't know yet, but I think we should all – I mean, it's very interesting. Why should marriage have such an impact on the way men imagine – their interests, right? Does it really, you know, plug into their notion of being protectors or being the most adult people in the public sphere, which I think maybe, but I think we have to ask a lot. We should ask all the married men we'd know, did they switch their vote and why?
And it may be that it relates also to just the right track, wrong track numbers that were so lopsided in feeling that the country's going down the tubes in a hurry, and that married men, especially if they have children, are not going to want to leave the country in worse shape to their kids than it is right now. And for one of the first times in American history, a lot of the married men and women think that's what's going to happen. And that shrinking horizon is real sadness for this country, don't you think?
Oh, yes, I think it is. I mean, the group that has gotten it right, I mean, big demographic group that has gotten it right, correctly, I should say, has been unmarried women. Unmarried women have been the most solid Democratic base. The absolutely most solid Democratic base is unmarried African American women. They are the most reliable voters, and I often, when I look at how they break out and express their attitudes towards particular policies, I'm almost always with them. I always think, gosh, if single African American women ran the country, we'd be in really good shape.
The pollster Celinda Lake has been studying this population, this demographic of unmarried single women. I don't know if she focuses on African-American single women. What is it about unmarried single women that makes them the most reliably Democratic demographic?
Well, one thing seems to be that they are out there earning a living. And they actually have a good handle on what insecurity looks like and what kinds of public policies engender insecurity. And so I think they are much more protected against the kind of terrorism appeal, I mean, the anti-terrorism appeal. I think they tend to be quite down to earth in their notions about public policy. That's my sense, anyway.
What about choice? Is that a big part there, too?
I think it probably is quite a big part of it, but I think it's as much economics.
Interesting. Cynthia Enloe is my guest today. She is a professor of international development, community, and social change, as well as women's studies at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's the author, most recently, of The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the New Age of Empire. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Cynthia, you've been giving a lecture recently entitled Where Are the Women in the U.S. War in Iraq, and Why Does It Matter? Do you want to clue us in?
In 30 seconds or less. Well, you know what I've been doing, Matt? Ever since the war began, well, actually in Iraq, I've been just trying to keep my eye on women in Afghanistan and women in Iraq, as well as those women in the U.S. who the militarizers, as I call them, the war wagers, absolutely count on. So in this country, I'm very attentive to, doesn't mean I know enough, but I'm very attentive to women who are military wives married to soldiers and women who are mothers of soldiers. I really keep track of them, and because I think governments can't wage wars if they lose the backing of military wives or mothers of soldiers. That could delegitimize a war waging effort faster than anything. But in Iraq, I keep track of those women who are trying to organize. There's something like 200 different Iraqi women's organizations now, and we hear about none of them.
What is the plight of Iraqi women right now?
What you hear primarily, and I haven't been to Iraq, and so I'm, you know, hearing this second and third hand, but what you hear primarily is that in the years of 03, 04, early 05, when there was still some effort to create new political parties, a new constitutional government, and a new constitution, that there was a great debate amongst women, sometimes very publicly and sometimes just privately, about what the new family code would be, what the new laws, that sometimes called the personal laws, would be. And not all women are quite divided, evidently, quite understandably, it's quite complex, about how much Islamic principles should inform the new state law. Under the Saddam Hussein regime, in his early years, it was quite a secularized personal law around custody and divorce and women's independence. As Saddam Hussein in the 90s was under such pressure because of the loss of the first Gulf War, but also because of the toll that the economic sanctions were taking, he tried to gain more support from more religious conservatives, and he then brought some of those conservative ideas into his own public policy. So women were looking at first to try and understand how much the Islamic principles should inform the new public law. Then there was also debate about whether Sharia, which is Islamic law, particularly around family affairs, should be made part of state law. And what has recently happened is that there's no space to even have those debates now. Now women in Iraq, from what I understand, are so preoccupied with just physical security that has taken over everything. So it's really pushed them out of the public space at a very time when they had very serious debates that they had to take part in. And now it's increasingly difficult to even have any public presence because of the deterioration of security.
That's a real indictment of Bush's Iraq war that we don't hear very often. And he brags about liberating everyone in Iraq. He brags about liberating women in Afghanistan and in Iraq, whereas the situation is quite different. The starting situation was quite different in the two places. Actually, in Iraq, it seems to have gone backwards. How about in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan, again, it depends on the province you're in. If you're down south, if you're in Helmand, and the provinces where now the insurgency is raging again, you're very likely as a woman to really feel as though you're going backwards. And I mean even going backwards from 2001, 2002. A lot of parents have pulled their daughters out of school, not because they don't believe in education, but because it's too frightening to send their daughters to school. In some other provinces, the real problem is that the warlords, these are who we used to call the Northern Alliance, the United States government, first backed, those warlords are almost as conservative as the Taliban. And so for a lot of women, they're under new strictures in those provinces as well.
And some of them are working with the Taliban right now, I understand. But
especially around the drug trade, around opium.
Right. You talked about a second ago, Cynthia Enloe, about the Pentagon being, the war makers being very concerned about the attitudes of women and of mothers of soldiers. You wrote said in something I was reading while I was preparing for this that mothers' politicization is making the Pentagon nervous. Its recruiting command and ad agencies have invested millions of dollars to retool ads that target mothers of potential recruits. Have you seen any of those retooled ads?
Oh, yes. The ad agency that got the big Army account, and, you know, the Defense Department is really one of the choice accounts to get if you are a advertising agency. The ad agency that got the Army recruiting account is called Leo Barnett.
Out of Chicago, I think.
Out of Chicago. And Leo Barnett has produced some very subtle, sophisticated ads directed right at mothers of young men. They're particularly, most of the ads really aim at young men. If they get young women, fine, but the ad target group is the mothers of sons.
And how are they tugging at mothers there?
Two things. One, to encourage mothers to think that this is a way for their sons to get a paid education, which in fact, if you call the GI hotline and other helplines, you'll find that it's very hard to get the benefits promised for higher education. And the second is that this will make your son more adult and more independent, make him, quote unquote, a man. And sometimes that's exactly the language used in the ads. And it really plays on mothers' concern that their 18 or 19-year-old, or maybe even 17 if they're being recruited early, that their son become adult, that he become mature. And lots of mothers, of course, wish for that. If the recruiter can say, this is one way I can help you parent your son from adolescence into adulthood, that can be made to seem quite appealing. They're having the hardest time with Latino mothers, however, because a lot of Latino mothers are of a generation that when they think militaries, they think the Guatemalan military, they think the Honduran military, and they are much harder to make an approach to. So the ad agencies now that are working for the Pentagon have a whole stream of advertising aimed just at Latino mothers.
It's interesting. They're also advertising, I guess it's spring break. It's another thing they're doing that I didn't know about. But The mother's angle, I mean, there are a lot of activist mothers now who've come out against the war, Cindy Sheehan, of course, being the most obvious. Tell me about her role and the role of other dissenting mothers.
Well, I was very fortunate just a couple of weeks ago to appear with Cindy Sheehan. We look like Mutt and Jeff. Your radio listeners can't see it, but I'm only 5'2", and Cindy is, gosh, I think she must be at least 5'8", 5'9". So we looked
Where were
very
you together?
At Syracuse. The folks at Syracuse held a wonderful conference called Feminism and War. It was just terrific. And they had the two of us on to begin. I mean, Cindy Sheehan was the star. But it was very interesting. She's a very modest person. I had never met her before. Very modest in her demeanor and the way she approaches people who come up to her who are full of admiration. She's very, very committed. She's very strong. You can see that. I mean, I think she always has been quite politically conscious. I think she's not a naive. I think oftentimes women who become politically active around war issues are portrayed as if they had never had a political thought in their head before, and then only out of their maternal inclinations do they become politically engaged.
Right, this is what O'Reilly was saying. She's a tool of the left. She doesn't know what she's
Everybody's
doing.
Everybody's a tool.
She's being manipulated.
Exactly.
There was more sexism, Cynthia Enloe, in the descriptions of her other than just being naive. I mean, there were some really nasty, ugly, disgusting, misogynistic things said about her, particularly on the web.
Yes, well, I think misogyny really is a tool for political discourse when they're dealing with women who otherwise are admirable in American culture. And the grieving mother of a, quote, fallen soldier is very hard to get at. And so what you have to do is you have to isolate her. You have to make sure that all her credentials that usually legitimize a woman, that is her motherhood, her grief, her son being in the military, that you have to knock all those pins out from under her. And I think it's really a sign of how nervous they are about motherhood in politics.
It's also a sign of how strong she is to have withstood that.
She is very resilient. She's had a lot of support from people like Leslie Kagan, who's a longtime anti-war activist, and also the Code Pink activist. It's been just great, I mean, to watch other people come around. Now, of course, here's the fine line. She has legitimacy with a lot of Americans if she can look as though she stands all by herself and has no political alliances and no political connections at all. If she is really just the lone mother out there expressing her grief. If she begins to be seen to have support, which she deserves, from Code Pink or from some other activists, then that is used by the O'Reillys, but others, against her. And even by ordinary people who first sympathize with her think, oh, well, she is part of a movement. Now I can make a judgment about a whole movement. She's not as legitimate as she was in my, you know, ordinary viewers' eyes when I thought she was just all by herself.
So it takes political agency away from her.
Yes.
What about Code Pink? How effective have they been, do you think?
I think they're very good at public actions. They know how to get attention, and given how difficult it's been for anybody to get any kind of attention for any kind of public actions. I mean, you all know if you've been at a rally recently and then you try to see whether it's ever covered by local or regional or national press, it isn't. And they've managed to really do a lot. I think partly because they're very witty. I heard Medea Benjamin speak, and she said, you know, I have never worn pink, right? Pink is not my color, but if that's what it takes, you know. So I think it's because they've got a lot of autonomy in their local actions, and because they've got a great sense of humor, as well as they're willing to be outrageous.
I'm speaking with Cynthia Enloe, who is a professor of international development, community and social change out at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, also a professor of women's studies and the author most recently of The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the New Age of Empire. Cynthia Enloe, you talked a little bit ago about women in Afghanistan and in Iraq. What about women soldiers in the U.S. Army over there? What is life like for them?
Yeah, well, the the news that your listeners probably realize that the U.S. military is now up to about 15% women in the active duty, but it's as high as 24% in the reserves and the National Guard. So it's really quite a different profile, and it matters that reservists and National Guard are being sent over. What we're hearing is a lot of well, there are several things. One, women, there have now been 65 women, U.S. military women killed in Iraq, 65 out of now close to 2,800. But there have been a lot of women seriously injured. There are women who are amputees, women American soldiers who are amputees. There was the first thought was that that would mean that policymakers would pull the rug. As soon as the first woman amputee was shown in a national newspaper, in fact, they would not be deployed. But that's not true. And I think that a lot of ordinary American citizens just do not see women as somehow always the protected now, that they can take the risks. On the other hand, women, one of the big risks that women face inside the U.S. military is being sexually assaulted by their own male peers. And this has barely gotten much attention. There are mounting figures now as to how many women have come forward. It's very risky to come forward if you're a woman to your next superior officer and say that you've been sexually harassed or even assaulted. So it takes a lot of guts for these women to come forward, but they're not getting much support from their own commanders.
Cynthia Enloe, some of those stories are just horrifying, too. I know that Janice Karpinski, who was running Abu Ghraib there for a bit and was the only officer there who was really disciplined. She reported that women soldiers, a couple of them anyway, died of dehydration after exercises in the hot heat because they were too afraid to go out and get water for fear of being raped by their own colleagues.
One of the things that Karpinski said is that when she went to General Sanchez, and of course she was a general and he was a general, but he was her superior in Iraq, and when he was the commander of Iraq forces, and went to him and his second in command, another senior officer, and said that she was getting reports of either threats of assault or actual assault on her women troops. Of course, she was commanding a mixed men and women's unit. She was told at the central command in Baghdad, well, you wanted to be here. Get used to it. So no understanding of how much this violated military discipline or undermined military morale.
It's not exactly the welcome mat, is it?
No, it isn't. On the other hand, the U.S. military now depends on women. So they have a great stake in keeping these stories quiet. Warner, the other senator from Virginia, actually did become quite outraged when it was combined with stories of rape at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and did hold at least some hearings. And there's some move at some levels in the State Department, in the Defense Department, to take this seriously. But at the field command, a lot of commanders do not want to hear it, and then they actually blame the victim.
There were the stories of sexual harassment are amazing too. I know Suzanne Swift, who said she was guilty. She was a victim of command rape, and also said when she asked her commanding officer where she should report for duty, he said, "In my bed." I mean, that is about as flagrant as it goes. And to hear, as you reported, Cynthia Enloe, that the commanding officers view it as nothing, total minimization, is horrifying. Unfortunately, we're out of time. My guest today on Progressive Radio has been Cynthia Enloe, Professor of International Development, Community and Social Change, as well as Women's Studies at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Her latest book, The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the New Age of Empire. Cynthia Enloe, it's great to see you again.
Matt, it's always nice to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.